from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, an airliner vanished, Ukraine's Crimea on the brink, the CIA versus the Senate Intelligence Committee, and more. Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 still missing amid frustration and confusion.
Until we find that craft, we'll do whatever it takes to find it. So there's no confusion about it.
At the White House, Ukraine's new prime minister asked Russia to back off.
My message to President Putin, Mr. Putin, tear down this wall, the wall of war, intimidation, and military aggression.
And President Obama sat down for some jokes and to pitch Obamacare to young Americans with comedian Zach Galifianakis.
Let's get this out of the way. What did you come here to plug?
Well, first of all, I think it's fair to say that I wouldn't be with you here today if I didn't have something to plug. Have you heard of the Affordable Care Act?
Oh, yeah, I heard about that. That's the thing that doesn't work.
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Nancy Cordes of CBS News, Josh Letterman of the Associated Press, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you see coming in Ukraine, Crimea? Where's your vote on overtime, prison sentences, deportation rates? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington, Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News. She's just returned from covering the GOP congressional win in Florida's special election this week. Nancy Cordes, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me back, Tom.
Great to have you. Also from Washington, Josh Letterman, White House reporter for the Associated Press. Josh, welcome. Great to have you here.
Nice to join you, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Nancy, and Josh.
Tough sound right here from southeastern Ukraine near Crimea, the town of Donetsk. Violent clashes breaking out today between pro-Russia demonstrators and supporters of Ukraine's interim government. At least one dead. It's rough down there. The diplomacy is getting rough, too. The interim prime minister was in Washington this week of Ukraine and at the UN Security Council. Here he was asking, does Russia want war?
We are looking for an answer to the question whether the Russians want war. Now, I'm sure, as the prime minister of Ukraine, which for decades had warm and friendly relations with Russia, I'm convinced that Russians do not want war.
Well, I guess nobody wants war but Josh Letterman. Here we are, the White House giving very tough warnings, and Germany's Angela Merkel also saying massive economic disruption in Russia if they go ahead with this referendum, essentially on secession in Crimea on Sunday, and yet it seems to be moving ahead. What's the White House anticipating now, Josh?
I think the White House is probably anticipating that this referendum is going to happen despite the tough talk that you mentioned from both the U.S., from Germany, and from others. There's really a last-ditch attempt now. You see Secretary of State John Kerry in London today to meet with his counterpart from Russia to say, is there any way that we can not have this referendum happen? Because once there's a vote in Crimea, if the people vote and say that they want to not be part of Ukraine anymore and perhaps join Russia, it's going to be much more difficult for the Obama administration and the world community to prevent that from happening. And that's one of the reasons you're seeing them really try and not have this vote happen. But at this point, there's no indication from Russia or from people in Crimea that they plan to cancel it.
Russia's UN ambassador to the Security Council, to the UN, Vitaly Churkin, repeating Russia's line, defending their actions in Ukraine, saying that the government in Kiev, after all the protests we saw, is not legitimate. Here's the Russian UN ambassador right here.
The legitimate legal president was overthrown and under the threat of physical force was forced to flee from Kiev. Those present in this chamber here know full well that the forceful overthrow of an authority is illegal.
And here's U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry at a Senate committee hearing yesterday in Washington saying there will be consequences and quickly if Crimea goes ahead with this Sunday vote.
If there is no sign of any capacity to be able to move forward and resolve this issue, there will be a very serious series of steps on Monday in Europe and here with respect to the options that are available to us.
And they're talking about all kinds of economic sanctions, maybe more. Nancy Cordes, how do you read the appetite on Capitol Hill for confrontation with Russia over Ukraine and Crimea?
Well, there was almost a unified desire to help Ukraine, and you saw a bill passed in the House that would do that. And it looked like it was heading that way in the Senate as well, but things kind of broke down late on Thursday. There are a number of Republicans who don't like the Senate package because not only does it help Ukraine, but it also imposes sanctions on Russia and it makes some reforms to the IMF, which Democrats argue will strengthen the IMF's hand in aiding the Ukraine, will give it more influence and will also give the U.S. more influence over the IMF. But there is a group of Republicans who are arguing that this is unrelated. Even the Speaker of the House is arguing that these reforms to the IMF are unrelated to the situation in Ukraine. They want to have the ability to debate that separately. And so now it looks as if the Senate will be going home on recess for a week without having passed a bill, which makes it appear that the U.S. is to some degree divided on what to do here.
Let me ask you, though, if they're divided on just $1 billion in aid for Ukraine, what about when it comes to actual confrontation? John Kerry's saying, look, the day after a Sunday vote on this, there will be consequences, serious consequences. Does he have Washington, Congress, behind him?
You're never going to have all of Congress unified behind him. There are a number of senators, for example, like Rand Paul of Kentucky, who are anti-interventionist. They don't want to put as much money into the situation. They certainly don't want to put force into the situation. But you do have a group of senators, eight senators, who are heading to Ukraine, who are going to be on the ground taking a look at the situation there. And these are some pretty influential senators. John McCain, for example, Dick Durbin, who the number two Democrat in the Senate. And they're going to be coming back and talking to their colleagues about what they've seen. So they have an ability to sway some of their colleagues and to say, I've seen the situation firsthand. Here's what I think we should do.
Here was the president midweek with the new interim prime minister of Ukraine, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, President Obama, with a message for Russia.
We will continue to say to the Russian government that if it continues on the path that it is on, then not only us, but the international community, the European Union and others will be forced to apply a cost to Russia's violations of international law.
Jack Beatty, what do you see unfolding here as Moscow appears to be ready to just move ahead?
And move ahead where? I mean, that's the question. Today's New York Times reports that there are reports that, quote, large numbers of Russians are being bused to the eastern Ukrainian cities of Kharkiv, Lugansk, and Donetsk so that they can agitate against this new government and under the supervision of Russian intelligence officers.
And that's addition to the Russian troops on the other side of the border in new exercises right next door to Ukraine now, Jack, both in and outside Ukraine then.
That's right. The Ukrainians say 80,000 Russian troops are drilling. The Russians admit to more like 10,000. And they talk about it. There's going to be a paratroop drop in Rostov near the Ukraine border. 1,500 paratroopers are going to be dropped in this exercise. Now, is this all just to intimidate Kiev and to make them think twice about going ahead, taking money from the West? Or is it the beginning of something else? We just don't know. And it's so clear that our threats are having no effect upon Mr. Putin. And this exercise in London today with Mr. Lavrov and Mr. Kerry seems to be pointless because the exit ramp we keep offering the Russians.
They're driving right by.
They
rumble,
go right
rumble.
By. Yes.
Josh Lederman, what about White House credibility here? I mean, the president has already been, I guess you'd have to say, mocked by some top Republicans when he lays down red lines at this point. I mean, how tough is the White House prepared to be with Moscow? How tough can the U.S. be here?
I think that's the key question, and I think that there's a bit of a crisis of credibility when it comes to not only this situation, but others where the administration has really tried to say, this is the line that you need not to cross, and then when countries flout it and there's not a response that is really forceful or decisive, it makes people a little bit concerned around the world about how serious Obama is about following through. We saw that obviously, with the situation in Syria. So I think that we will see, we've already seen the United States put some visa bans into effect against Ukrainians and Russians that the United States says is responsible for some of this unrest. We have an executive order that Obama has signed that gives himself the authority to put sanctions in place should he want to, but so far hasn't taken that step. But I think all indications are that if this referendum does happen, there will be some sanctions that are levied. And other than that, you know, it's going to be difficult. You have Europeans, notwithstanding some of what we're talking about with Germany, there are concerns there about doing a little bit too much with sanctions, considering that they have a very close economic relationship with Russia. And there's some interdependence there, particularly when it comes to energy issues, that make it a little bit more difficult for them to just cut off their relationship economically.
Jack, the whole world watching, a little bit concerned, Josh says. I mean, who knows what the ramifications will be? The first redrawing of international boundaries in Europe by force since World War II, I've heard this described as. This is new territory, Jack.
It is new territory, and it may be that we have to get patient about it. I mean, there's been an urgency. We're going to prevent this from happening. Well, of course, that was all sort of theatrical. Nothing was going to be prevented. George Kennan really, I think, had the right idea. You've just got to be patient here and not force things to a confrontation, because we don't know what can happen on the other side.
Of course, he said, don't push NATO too close to Russia. What if Russia, under Vladimir Putin, is pushing out itself back toward its Soviet Union boundaries? Jack Beatty, please stand by. Nancy Cordes with CBS News, Josh Letterman with the Associated Press. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. In the news, Crimea on the brink, the CIA versus the Senate Intelligence Committee. Obama pushes overtime. And where's the plane? Malaysian Airlines Flight 370. Josh Letterman is here, White House reporter for the Associated Press. Nancy Cordes is with us, congressional correspondent for CBS News, and Jack Beatty as well. Everybody thinking about that plane this week. I don't know what to say about it. Still no great sign of it. Here was yet another press conference earlier today in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. The defense minister, acting transport minister there, telling reporters that ships and aircraft were expanding now their search.
A normal investigation becomes narrower with time, I understand, as new information focuses on the search. But this is not a normal investigation. In this case, the information we have forces us to look further and further afield.
Further and further afield. I mean, this doesn't, a couple of Americans on there, but the whole world watching this. I mean, Jack, at this point, I don't know what to say about this airline. Everything seems to have been said this week. Everybody kind of fixated on the mystery of disappearance. And yet, nobody with a good answer and what seems to be a bigger and bigger field of search.
Yes, and bigger range of hypotheses about what could have happened. I've been looking at the web, and you see these scenarios. Someone might have stolen the plane, and then they talk to pilots who say, well, it could fly this far. The runway needs to be this. Yeah, they could probably land it on a beach if it were hard enough, on and on and on. So one just doesn't know. What is certain is this has got to be, you know, anguish piled upon grief for the families involved. Just this, obviously, whatever happens, they're not going to get their relatives back, and the grief will be there. But just the anguish of not knowing and of the continual almost sort of pratfalls, as the Malaysian government says this thing, says one thing one day and one the next. And by the way, the news, our media has gotten some things wrong too. The Wall Street Journal seemed to have somewhat misstated you know, the business about whether the plane was sending back information or not, or how that was working to a satellite. So we just don't know. We are in the dark in every way.
Lots of confusion here as that search goes on. I want to bring it home to American politics. A Florida special House election this week. And Nancy Cordes, you were there to watch this. Tell us about what was at stake, who against whom, and what outcome with what ramifications or signaling, Nancy.
Well, what was at stake nationally for the two parties essentially was a bragging rights. They wanted to be able to say that heading into this fall's midterm elections, that they've got the upper hand, that they've got the momentum. And it was also sort of a test for these messages that are emerging on both sides on Obamacare. Now that it is actually being enrolled, people are being enrolled, and the system is now in place to some degree. How do people feel about it, and are they willing to vote based on how they feel about it? So you had the Republican, who ended up winning by 2 points, David Jolly, arguing that the program is just too broken, that it needs to be repealed, and the Democrat, Alex Sink, saying, I don't think that the people in this district want it to be repealed, they want it to be fixed. Obviously, his argument appears to have won the day, but there's a caution here, which is that we don't really know whether Obamacare was what decided this race, whether Republicans are putting too much stock in the idea that people are voting just based on Obamacare, and whether this really does have much of a predictive factor for what happens in the fall. What we do know is that both parties spent prodigiously on this race. The candidates only put in about one third of the money here in this race. Two thirds of it came from the parties and from outside groups. It was the most expensive special election ever.
And here we have on Tuesday, after his victory, Republican David Jolly pointing to Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, as part of concern about it, he said, as part of the reason for his victory.
The concern about Obamacare is a view of government that has more government in our lives, more government in our businesses. It cripples the economy. It hurts employment. There's an individual mandate that people cannot embrace as a view of government that they think is right for the future of our country. So, yes, Obamacare was an issue. The voters made it an issue.
Josh Letterman, did you feel a shudder in the White House when the Republican won with Obamacare as part of the big debate in Florida in the special election? What's the signal here for Republicans, for Democrats?
There certainly was a shudder, and here's what the White House and a lot of Democrats are concerned about. They're definitely concerned about the Obamacare issue. They're also concerned about low Democratic turnout. This is something that you've been hearing over and over from Obama as he travels around the country raising money for Democrats for the midterm elections. Democrats in national presidential years, they know how to get their voters out, and they tend to do rather well. In midterm years, Democratic turnout really drops off, and they have a problem, and Democrats are really concern that this race was one indication that it's going to be difficult to get their voters excited and to the polls, and that they may end up losing a lot of seats in November simply because they can't get their own voters ginned up for this election.
Jack, I want to put it to you, but let me put it in the context also of the president himself being out there this week, talking up the Affordable Care Act in an unusual setting, this kind of send-up interview show with comedian Zach Galifianakis, funny guy, between two ferns, parody kind of a thing here. But the president dove in with both feet here, giving as good as he got, talking about all kinds of things, including taking the chance to push for a young audience Obamacare.
If they get that health insurance, it can really make a big difference. And they've got till March 31st to sign up.
I don't have a computer, so how does...
Well, then you can call 1-800-318-2596.
I don't have a phone. I'm off the grid. I don't want you people like looking at my text, if you know what I mean.
First of all, Zach, nobody's interested in your texts. But second of all, you can do it in person.
And it got off into crazier territory. Here's Galifianakis saying, hey, what's it like to be the last black president?
I have to know, what is it like to be the last black president?
Seriously? What's it like for this to be the last time you ever talked to a president?
It must kind of stink, though, that you can't run, you know, three times. You know?
Actually, I think it's a good idea. You know, if I ran a third time, it'd be sort of like doing a third Hangover movie. Didn't really work out very well, did it?
Of course, Galifianakis is well known for his Hangover movies. Jack Beatty, what about this? In Florida, it's going against the Democrats. On the national stage, the president getting a lot of attention for jumping in. Good sport, I guess. But some said not dignified enough for the presidency. Into this parody kind of conversation about Obamacare and more, where does it leave the needle, Jack?
Well, on policy, the president has, you know, said we've got some good news. By the beginning of March, 4.2 million people had selected a plan. That doesn't mean they're paid for it. But if you add in the Medicaid expansion, we're up into the, you know, maybe 10 million people or somewhere around there. On the other hand, February enrollment was off quite a bit from the January pace. And the composition of that enrollment, the thing he was talking about with Zach getting young people, that was down too. That was 27% of people 18 to 34 in February, and the administration had put out an ideal target of 40% to get the right mix of young people in the system in order to pay for the old people. You need 40%, And so that doesn't look so good. On the other hand, you get people who, experts on this, who say, well, no, that really, the insurance companies don't expect 40%. They have built in something lower than that into their projections. Who knows? It's clear, though, that they're not getting the target that they wanted. But on the policy, on the politics, it's so clear that the Republicans have found a mobilizing issue for now, the third election in a row on Obamacare, and they're pushing it very hard among senior citizens who voted for Romney by 61%, and this is their these are the people most opposed to Obamacare. They believe it comes directly out of Medicare, and the Republic and the Chamber of Commerce ran ads talking about that $716 billion that President Obama and Obamacare cut out of Medicare in order to make Obamacare work. That was a big issue in the presidential campaign. And as you look ahead to Senate seats and you say, well, what's the composition of the electorate in these states? It doesn't look good for the Democrats. In West Virginia, 43% of voters are seniors. In South Dakota, 38%. In Montana, another Democratic race, 41% are seniors. The national average is 29%. So you have you've got states where seniors are overrepresented, white seniors. They are angry about Obamacare. Florida shows they, at least implies, they can be mobilized on it. Very tough sledding.
Midterm elections coming up. Who are you going to mobilize here? The president looking for the youth. We've got the special election in Florida. Let's get our callers in here. From Florida, Ed's calling from Palm Beach. Ed, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Tom. How are you doing today?
Okay. What do you see, Ed?
Well, you know, was it a good time to go on with Zach Galifianakis, you think, right now? We're talking tough all over the world. And the president's on doing, you know, kind of a comedy parody, number one. And number two, I think, you know, a lot of things I've been listening to, I can tell you from my own personal knowledge that healthcare costs have gone way up for premiums. I mean, I don't know if it's, you know, because we've expanded coverage so much, but we cover so many more things. Like I have, an 11-month-old child, and when I put him on my insurance, he was an additional $300 a month just for him.
Just like
it
may that.
Have to be done on the medical cost. Yeah, just yep. like that.
It comes at you quick when you start getting into health care. Of course, you know, who's going to make the case about where the best coverage and the most economical coverage is there? Ed, I appreciate your call. I'll take it to our panel. Let me get one more here first. Alex in Burlington, Vermont. Alex, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was just calling because I really thought that the Between Two Ferns interview with Obama was brilliant. First of all, I think that it shows how adept the administration is in getting a message out to a targeted audience. And Between Two Ferns has been on for a while. There have been a lot of episodes. I think it probably caught Republicans off guard because they have no sense of humor, and they think that Democrats have a monopoly on humor, and it's true, because if you're an old white man, you probably don't go on Funny or Die and watch videos. But for them to come out and, you know, for representatives to be sending out tweets saying this is beneath the office of the President of the United States, apparently it's not beneath the office of the President of the United States to, you know, offer no-bid contracts to cronies.
But what about being on a parody show while the Russian troops are massed on the border of Ukraine? Do you have a problem with that, Alex, or is that just the media world we live in now, many facets?
I think it's the best time to do it.
Alex, I appreciate your call as well. Nancy Cordes, I mean, there's a lot here. There's the dignity of the presidency. I don't know how that's played out in Washington this week. There's the composition of the U.S. Congress after these midterm elections in the fall, and Republicans hoping to have both sides of Capitol Hill in their pocket. What do you see now coming? You going to be covering an all-Republican Capitol Hill, Nancy?
That's a great question, Tom. You know, I think that there was a lot more hand-wringing on the airwaves than there was actually here in Washington about the president's decision to do this web parody from Funny or Die. Most people understand that he's trying to reach a target audience. They desperately need to boost the numbers of young people who are signing up for Obamacare in a hurry. And I'm not really sure what the difference is between doing something like this and slow jamming the news with Jimmy Fallon or, you know, appearing on a on a late night TV show with Jay Leno or David Letterman or any of the other people he has visited in the past. I'm not sure, you know, where you draw the line and say this is dignified and this is not. So I think here in D.C., you didn't hear many Republicans sort of going after him on that front. On the election front, yes, I do think that Democrats are concerned. You know, this race in Florida 13, in St. Petersburg, Clearwater, this should have been a winnable race for them. Yes, it was represented by a Republican for 60 years, but the president also won in this district by 4 points in 2008 and by 1 point in 2012. There are a lot of young people who have moved into that district, so I do think that they are looking at the situation there. They had a candidate with a lot of name recognition. She almost won the governor's race.
Yeah, Alex.
And thinking if she wasn't able to win there, what do we need to do? How do we need to change our message for the fall to shore up not just our House members, but some of our senators as well who are up for re-election and who are frankly vulnerable.
John in St. Helena, South Carolina. John, you're on the air. What do you think?
I think like this. I don't know why white folks always vote against their own interests. Obamacare is the best thing that ever happened since Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare. They don't care about the neighbors, their relatives, and the reason I think they voted against the rich, they think they're going to be rich, but the 1% isn't turning any money over to them. What they need to do is get behind Obama and the Democratic Party and push his agenda, not the agenda for somebody they made a mistake in voting for, but the president agenda.
John, you lay it down very clear, and I appreciate your call. Let me hold that one and get one more right here. Buffalo, New York. Terry, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Say, listen, how come nobody mentions that Richard Nixon was on Laugh-In 40 years ago?
Sock it to me. Sock it to me.
Right. Sock it to me.
Yeah, okay, fair enough, right? Zach Galifianakis and Sock it to me on Laugh-In. Presidents can laugh, too, even when there are big issues. One more. Jim in Stuart, Florida. Jim, you're on.
Hey, Tom, I just wanted to share that I have a small bakery here in Stuart, and I have an employee who's making $8 an hour, a young man.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be encouraging him to use Obamacare. In fact, I may even go through the website myself with him because it's important for me to see him with something.
Are you, let's see, you've got a postponed requirement to support his health care, right? They pushed that off a ways, Jim.
Well, as far as I understand it, we fly under the radar because we have, you know, because we only have a couple of employees, yeah, and only one full-time employee. So, but that said, I still want this fellow to get as much help as possible. I might even, you know, once we do the math and see how much it's going to cost him on a monthly basis, I may pay him either in the paycheck itself or under the table to, you know, for him to have sufficient funds, yeah, to pay for it.
Jim, you're the president's dream right now, sitting down with your young employee and getting him signed up online. Josh Letterman, here it is. You know, that election is not so far away now. Is the White House rallying Congress people saying, don't bail on us on supporting Obamacare, stand tough?
They are. And what they're also saying is, instead of trying to defend the law, why don't we talk about how we can fix it? Why don't we talk about the positive things about it? Let's focus on the fact that people are getting coverage for pre-existing conditions and they can keep their children on their health insurance and the benefits. And they'd like that to be the focus heading into the midterms.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, a deadly Harlem gas explosion brought down two buildings. New Yorker Kathy Smith lives nearby.
I heard the explosion and I looked. I thought it was much closer than it was because the suction from my windows like and went back out.
Facebook executive Sheryl Sandberg launched a campaign to empower assertive young girls, saying don't call them bossy. Her Ban Bossy campaign. Beyonce's on board.
Join us to Ban Bossy.
I'm not bossy. I'm the boss.
She's the boss. And longtime movie trailer voiceover king Hal Douglas died at 89. In 2002, he parodied himself, playing an announcer named Jack in the trailer for Jerry Seinfeld's documentary, Comedian.
In a world where laughter was king.
No, in a world, Jack.
What do you mean, no, in a world?
It's not that kind of movie.
Oh? Okay.
How many times have we heard that voice? Nancy Cordes is with us, congressional correspondent for CBS News, Josh Letterman, White House reporter for the Associated Press. Jack Beatty's here. We're looking at a week in the news. The president on Thursday made remarks before signing an executive order in Washington revising federal rules to ensure that more workers are paid overtime.
If you're working hard, you're barely making ends meet, you should be paid overtime, period. Because working Americans have struggled through stagnant wages for too long. Every day I get letters from folks who just feel like they're treading water. No matter how hard they're working, they're putting in long hours, they're working harder and harder just to get by, but it's always at the end of the month real tight.
President hopes that the changes will put more overtime pay in more pockets. House Speaker John Boehner came right back and said this will kill jobs.
If you don't have a job, you're not qualified for overtime. So what do you get out of it? You get nothing. The president's policies are making it difficult for employers to expand employment. And until the president's policies get out of the way, employers are going to continue to sit on their hands.
They're going to sit on their hands, says John Boehner. No jobs. The president says people who are working deserve overtime. Craig in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. You're on the air, Craig. What do you think?
Hi, Tom. I suggested to Senator Grassley a few years ago to eliminate all overtime. It might create more jobs, and people might be able to spend more time with their families. Some of these employers just take advantage of their employees and ruin their health.
Oh, you mean don't even allow people to work more than 40 hours a week, even if they were paid more for it, Craig?
Right.
Well, yeah, but then people, a lot of people need overtime these days to make ends meet. I mean, wages haven't exactly gone up, Craig.
Well, that's my whole point. We need a better, more fair distribution of the wealth, that's for sure.
Craig, I appreciate your call. Josh Letterman, the president said in his State of the Union speech he would use the executive power of his office if Congress wouldn't go along with him to push his agenda. Is this an example of that?
It is. And, you know, Tom, I hate to be the cynic, but the way you have to look at this all is through the lens of the midterm elections. You take this thing on overtime and look at it in the context of some of the other things the president's doing, minimum wage, pushing Congress to increase the minimum wage, but then taking action himself to do it for federal contractors and asking for an expansion of the earned income tax credits. Democrats are trying to set up an economic argument where they look like they're on the side of the middle class and people who are trying to get into the middle class, and the Republicans are standing in the way of that type of economic prosperity. So even though Obama and the White House know that few of these things are likely to happen, at least the ones that require legislation, they're pushing them because it builds a broader theme that they hope will be effective for Democrats up and down the ballot in the midterms.
But he can push the overtime parameters, right? Can't the Department of Labor come in and do that, Josh, on its own authority?
Sure. It's a regulatory process, so it takes a long time, and he will certainly get some opposition probably from business groups who, as you've noted, Boehner has already had some comments about this. So we'll have to see how much pushback he has. But in terms of the regulations, that is something he can do.
Nancy, I mean, I well remember working for an hourly wage, and when it was over 40 hours a week, really appreciating that overtime in there, partly because, to our caller Craig's point, you know, 40 hours a week is already a lot. And if you're going to work more, you want to be paid more. And if they didn't really need it, that OT extra pay kept them from laying it on. What's the talk on the Hill about this? Are Democrats thinking this is a good idea of the president's, or does it just look like window dressing to them?
Well, Democrats like it because they argue that when these overtime rules were first established, that we've kind of run into a situation where there's this loophole that, it was established that people who made over a certain amount weren't eligible for overtime.
Call them exempt, suddenly like they're a big boss, even though they're not.
Exactly. And now it affects people who make as little as $23,000 a year. So they say, that obviously needs to change. I don't think you're going to see as ferocious opposition from Republicans on this front as you do on, say, the minimum wage. On the minimum wage, they've got a strong argument that, look, if you raise the minimum wage, it's possible that employers will hire fewer workers. When it comes to overtime, it's a little trickier to make that argument. But, you know, regardless of whether this is ever something that Congress needs to decide or not, as Josh said, this is something that Democrats are going to continue pushing. I mean, every time that Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid opens his mouth right now, he talks about the Koch brothers and these billionaire investors and businessmen that are giving so much money to Republican candidates. No matter what issue he's talking about, it always comes back to the Koch brothers. And obviously, they have decided that they are going to make this push from now through November, that they are the party of the little guy and Republicans are the party of billionaires.
Jack, I'll come to you. Let me get James in Columbia, South Carolina. James, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
Obama keeps pushing these executive orders and stuff on businesses. First, you're talking about mandatory health insurance. Now you're talking about increasing overtime pay and everything. I'm kind of worried that we're moving into a socialist idea. He's going to keep pushing that where you're going to start telling how much business can charge for an item so more people can afford them, and then who you can hire because we need to get certain people hired. And that's more of a socialist view on commerce than, you know, the U.S. idea of let commerce drive itself and let the people decide how commerce should run itself.
James, I take your point if they went way out there. But here we're talking about the minimum wage. You know, it's as low as it's been in a long time in inflation-adjusted terms. Overtime. I don't know if you've worked by the hour. Maybe you have, James. You know, when it's over 40 hours a week, don't people deserve OT?
Well, I was in the military, and I'm going to tell you right now, I put in more than 40 hours a week. Of course, I was compensated, you know, medically and stuff like that. But then since I've retired, I'm self-employed, and I work my butt off for probably less than minimum wage just trying to make sure I got food on the table. But, you know, if you keep saying minimum wage is not enough, then you got to tell people, then you need to look at how you spend your money, because I know there's people that can't afford things and they do use their money wisely, but I guarantee you there's a lot of people in the U.S. that do not use their money wisely and they blow it instead of planning properly.
Yeah, you got to have some in the first place. James, I appreciate your call. Jack Beatty, there are a lot of perspectives cutting through these woods.
Yes, but the context, just to point that out, I mean, I'm reading here in the New York Times, the portion of the economy that goes to worker pay has now dropped to an all-time low. That's number one. And then on the inequality...
I would call that the opposite of socialism.
Yes, my gosh. And then on the inequality front, it came out this week that Wall Street bonuses paid in 2013 exceeded the total amount earned by minimum wage workers by $11 billion.
And we're talking about lots and lots of minimum wage workers, fewer Wall Street big guys.
You know, there's a wonderful book by my friend Cullen Murphy called Are We Rome? Meaning the United States. And in there, he quotes a historian of the Roman Empire who said, if I had to put Rome's decline in three words, it would be fewer had more.
And you spell that R-O-M-E, or we hope not, USA. Dave in Newburyport, Massachusetts. Dave, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call.
Yeah.
I wanted to point out the fact that I've been working since I was 53. All my life, I'm 53.
Yeah.
And I don't view overtime as helpful.
Why not?
I see that the government takes a big, fat, extra whopping chunk, and the employer gets off light on the fact that he doesn't have to have somebody else with benefits. He just simply has to jam me into overtime. And what happens then is basically less workers.
And you just feel strong-armed into the extra hours without a whole lot of payoff.
Exactly. And what do I really get when the government takes this big whopping chunk? Maybe I get it back at the end of the year.
Yeah.
And, you know, I like to...
And maybe not, but that's a long time to wait. Dave, I appreciate your call. Josh Letterman... You know, here we are. People are going to look at this in all kinds of ways. The president putting together this interesting matrix of moves that he can take. What about the deportation theme that he struck this week? The Obama administration has been very big on deportation, record numbers of deportees. Why that one this week, saying, hey, let's review that, maybe reel it in?
Here's what's happened. For a long time, Hispanics have been a really loyal constituency group for Obama. They voted for him overwhelmingly in both elections. And I think they've given him the benefit of the doubt that even though deportations, as you mentioned, were close to 2 million people that have been removed from the U.S. Under Obama's leadership, that because he was publicly pushing for an immigration reform, especially in his second term, so forcefully, that he was at least trying to get this done the right way with laws that have to be passed if we really want to overhaul our immigration system. Now, the immigration advocates have basically lost patience with Congress, and they've lost patience with Obama for turning to Congress about it, and they have really ramped up the pressure, the rhetoric. You have prominent Latino leaders, even on the floor of the House, calling him the deporter-in-chief. This is very alarming for the White House when you start to get this level of blowback from groups that are supposed to be your allies. And so the White House has made what I think is a very risky decision, but one we'll have to see how it pays off for them, in saying that they're going to take a new look at our deportation policies, see if there's a way that he can implement that in a way that's more humane. At the same time, that's sure to open him up for criticism from Republicans who are already looking to say he's overreaching, he's exceeding his authority as president. They attacked him on how he's implemented Obamacare and taken too much leeway with that, what he did with the Dreamers. And so he risks making it more difficult in the long term to get immigration reform done, perhaps, if he makes the political climate more difficult by taking unilateral steps now.
Tough calculation, the president moving from a get-tough position on deportation to maybe something a little less tough. I want to turn to Eric Holder at the Department of Justice, Attorney General there, saying let's trim back sentences for drug offenders. Here's Holder.
By reserving the most severe penalties for dangerous and violent drug traffickers, we can better promote public safety, deterrence, and rehabilitation while saving billions of dollars and strengthening communities.
It's just a trim. Of course, we've got the prison population is the world's largest in this country, one in about every 100 adults locked up. Now he wants to carve the average back, the average sentence for drug dealer from 62 months down to 51 months. Josh, what's pushing that?
What's pushing which part of it?
Well, the Attorney General's desire to trim the time drug dealers spend in prison.
I think there's been a criticism that has come for a long time toward the Obama administration that perhaps he hadn't done enough to address some of these issues, specifically dealing with law enforcement, things that disproportionately affect minorities. And so you've seen in Obama's second term, he's been much more emboldened, as has his Attorney General, to take steps to try and change the way that we do that in terms of sentencing. They've started to look at whether they can grant some clemency to people who maybe were convicted on drug offenses but haven't otherwise shown that they pose a major risk. The clock is counting down for Obama and his presidency, and as it looks increasingly like he's not going to be able to get any of these major legislative achievements through, he's really starting to look at what can I do for American society? What changes can I make on my own? Even if I get some blowback for it, that could really make a difference for a lot of people.
And do we want to be the world leader in incarceration? Holder saying this over-reliance on incarceration is not just financially unsustainable. It comes, he said, with human and moral costs that are impossible to calculate. Nancy Cordes, I've got to come to you on Dianne Feinstein, the Senate Intelligence Committee, and her standing up and just going after the CIA this week, saying they're spying on us, the intimidation going on. Here she was Tuesday in the Senate. Dianne Feinstein, chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee.
I have grave concerns that the CIA's search may well have violated the separation of powers principles embodied in the United States Constitution, including the speech and debate clause. It may have undermined the constitutional framework essential to effective congressional oversight of intelligence activities or any other government function.
Nancy Cordes, I know this is a big, complicated story. What does it come down to? Is the Senate Intelligence Committee going to bring out its tough report on enhanced interrogation torture as it likes? Is it going to back off to get the CIA to back off? Is the CIA in trouble here?
Tom, I think that this is an unbelievable story, and I think that you and I are going to be talking about this 6 months from now and a year from now, because it is not going away. What you have is the Senate Intelligence Committee and the head of it, Dianne Feinstein, who's not a bomb thrower, you know.
On the contrary, big supporter of the intelligence agency.
Right. I mean, she's been their best friend up until now. basically accusing the CIA of spying on her staffers as they were conducting this long-term investigation into the CIA's use of harsh interrogation tactics. She says that the CIA director himself, Director Brenner, told her this. And now he is saying, I never said anything of the kind. So you basically have a complete standoff here. And tensions ratcheted up, not just between the CIA and the Intelligence Committee, but between senators on that committee. Republicans who never wanted to do this investigation in the first place, many of whom didn't have a problem with enhanced interrogation. They didn't liken it to torture. They thought it was effective. Not wanting to go down this road. And Democrats saying, look, we have to have the ability to oversee the CIA without worrying that they're going to be spying on their partners.
What a picture here. Surveillance gets so big, and the next thing you know, maybe it's turned on the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, the Oversight Committee itself. The spectacle this week of Edward Snowden beaming in from Russia to South by Southwest in Austin, Texas, saying oversight isn't working, America. Wow, I'm sure we will be talking and hearing about this for a long time. Thanks to all three of you for being with us. Nancy Cordes, congressional correspondent for CBS News. It is always terrific to have you. Thanks very much for being with us today, Nancy.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
Josh Letterman, White House reporter for the AP. Josh, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
And Jack, thanks so much for joining us today, Jack.
Thank you.
Listeners, follow us at onpointradio.org. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook NPR. Thanks for being here. This is On Point.